So overcoming adversity for me has become a superpower. It is a superpower.
Hello and welcome to Prescription for Hope. That's MetroHealth President and CEO, Dr. Erica Steed, now nearing the end of her first year leading Cleveland's Safety Net Health System. This is our second chat with Dr. Steed. The first was just a few weeks into her tenure. This conversation is Dr. Steed like you've never heard her. She opens up about growing up in Chicago, about being held back and muted as a young woman, about what fuels her passion for equity, and how the tragic loss of her mother called her into healthcare leadership. I started off by asking about something of vital importance.
What I wanted to ask first, these Chicago peppers you talk about. how do you say them?
They're jardinera.
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 And
yes.
How hot are they?
You can get them mild or you can get them hot. Depending on what your comfort level is.
And you get them hot?
I get them hot. But really, the walk away from a jardinera pepper is the vinegar sauce that it's marinated in. And it just gives a flavor bomb to whatever it is that you're
eating. We should have done like a hot ones.
Yeah, You should have brought them with you, and maybe we should have tested them together.
Would you be open to doing that?
I would love to do that. And actually, I've been trying to bring the jardinera to Cleveland ever since I arrived here. But as you can see, I'm serious about my peppers.
What was it like growing up in Chicago in the 1980s?
Oh my gosh.
So I did a little research. The Bulls drafted Michael Jordan when you were seven. The Bears, Super Bowl Shuffle. That was when you were eight.
Yeah.
What was it like?
You know, Chicago is just a vibrant city. And actually, we had a lot going on, as you can imagine. And yes, being a part of a hometown that was full of all of these sports teams and sports phenomenons, I remember I used to dance to the Super Bowl Shuffle. I had a nice childhood, a nice upbringing, just full of happiness and full of just being engaged in all of the goodness that Chicago afforded, and having all of these powerful idols and superstars, the Michael Jordan era, the one-peat and two-peat and the three-peat and the four-peat. Oh my gosh. which my entire household were Bulls fans and Bears fans. So this is the time when you had good reason to be a Bears fan. But you know, for me, my life was full. It was full in a good way. And there's not one moment of my childhood that doesn't have a great memory associated with it.
Rich Central High School?
Yes.
What was the breakdown of the students, black and white?
It was a very mixed population back then. So I would say the demographic was very close to 50-50, but then it was creeping up to a 60%. Minority population, 40% Caucasian population or some type of other demographic. But the rich township schools, they were super competitive. And so I was always an athlete all throughout, not even just high school, but I actually went to the Junior Olympic Games even through my upbringing there.
And did you live in a house?
I did. I was always fortunate to. So in my very, very, very beginning that I can't even recall, my family had very humble beginnings. So I recall my parents always talking about we started out in an apartment. because I was born in the city and then I was raised in the suburbs. But from my earliest memory, I've always had a house. I've always had the house. I've always had the dogs. So we've always grown up in a way in which certainly hard work was demonstrated and what that can present to a family. So moving from the city, so there was an event that actually caused our relocation from the city of Chicago to the suburbs. Our house got broken into several times over in the city, and I recall in the middle of the night, my father just had enough. He packed up the house that we were living in the city of Chicago, and we were in the car, and all I can remember from there is I was living in a completely different place, and that became my upbringing in the suburbs.
How old were you
in the movie? I was going into first grade, so 6 or 7.
How and when did you encounter racism growing up?
So fortunately for me, I was always immersed in communities that was diverse, in communities that was much more mature than the reality around me. So I can honestly say my upbringing was very much a bubble. So growing up on my initial street that I lived when we moved to the suburbs, it was very interesting in comparison to the street that I came from, where it was a heavy saturation of minorities, and then moving into Country Club Hills, I was the only one in my classroom. So it was a very strange type of dynamic in my earlier years in school. But even still, I can't say that in my earlier beginning I encountered racism really until I was graduating from high school and actually getting into my college life. That's when I really started to feel different. I appreciated the diversity of my upbringing, but I remember saying I remember going home and talking to my family when I was starting college. And I said, wow, now I know what it's like to be Kizzy.
I want to press pause here. Dr. Steed is referring to Kizzy Kinte from the 1977 TV miniseries Roots. Kizzy, an enslaved young woman played by Leslie Uggams, does the unforgivable by learning to read.
Yes, Mom.
And you see to it that the demand irons be polished up and shiny and... What's that?
These letters spell out my name. Missy Ann showed me when we used to play school. And she showed me about reading and writing. That's a Kizzy. K-I-Z-Z-Y. Oh!
Don't you never do nothing like that again. No reading, no writing. Never, ever. You hear me?
And I felt totally different. I never really related to that there are differences in how you're treated because of the color of your skin or anything like that. I've always been afforded opportunities really because I was always talented and I was an athlete. And when you're an athlete, you live in a different world. You're really shielded from a lot of the realities that a lot of people face. So all the way up into when I actually got into the real world in college, I was really sheltered from that. The individuals that I was around was more interested in my talent as opposed to whatever racial biases or prejudices or whatever the case may be. But my first exposure was not until I was well into my 20s, I would say, with racism and really starting to live through adversity. So I was independent. I was in school, very competitive, expose myself to professors that has my future in their hands. And my gosh, I you know, went through experiences like you wouldn't believe where I felt like I had to work harder, not necessarily because for any other reason. I couldn't figure it out. I felt like I was being mistreated, and I was actually mistreated. It was very conspicuous to the outside eye. It was conspicuous to anyone seeing it. But I was so hard on myself because I was trying to figure out how to drive perfection and try to change or assimilate myself. And there was no way for me to show up as the individual that I needed to be, just because the person on the other side really controlling or tipping the scale was someone who didn't see me at all. In essence, and again, I was shielded as a child. I was shielded as a teenager. And here I am in my early, going in at the top of 20, and I just get hit with the shock, like, this is who you are. And now I felt like all eyes were on me, and I had to change because of just the way I was being treated. I'm searching for something within myself. I felt like I had to prove it to myself. I had to prove this individual wrong. And I was chasing something that could not become a reality. But quite frankly, that is the reality. It's unfortunate, but you always have to be the smartest in the room. You always have to be the one that is overly experienced. You always have to be the subject matter expert in everything. You always have to be overly credentialed, or else you're automatically going to feel that imposter syndrome if you don't overqualify. And honestly, ever since I started that first exposure, I almost became OCD with it. And a strive for perfection was a necessary component of just surviving in just our reality. It's always a drive for something. You always have to feel like you have to have the credential. You have to have every single experience and exposure. You can't just perform at mediocre, because mediocrity is not an option. It's never an option. You always have to be the high performer. You always have to be the one who shows up at the top of the morning before everyone gets there. You always have to be the one that shuts down the house. So it's always been like that for me. When I learned that someone can take something from you without any good reason at all, but don't give them a reason to take it from you.
Yeah, that's a tremendous amount of stress.
It is.
It's toxic stress.
It's toxic stress, but for me too, I've learned that it is also muscle building. So overcoming adversity for me has become a superpower. It is a superpower. Being able to overcome the challenges that life throws at you, being able to overcome being threatened, being able to overcome coexisting in spaces where people don't see you, being able to overcome being in spaces where you have no voice, being able to overcome being muted. So even if you have a voice, someone puts you on mute. Being able to overcome earning yourself a position where you are at the table, but despite the fact that you're at the table, people walk right past you because they don't see you at the table. And even if you're at the table in an earned place, people talk right over you because they don't hear what you have to say. So a lot of that is adversity building. It is. And despite having to prepare yourself for the most significant of circumstances, that's the easy stuff to me. The more difficult stuff is teaching yourself how to be emotionally intelligent through the pain of your reality.
You mentioned that you were threatened. What happened?
I would say threatened comes in multiple shapes and sizes. I would say I'm not threatened. People are threatened. People are threatened by confidence. People are threatened by intelligence. People are threatened by all the credentials that you can wear after your name. And quite frankly, I've shortened my credentials. I don't wear all my credentials. And I've been in circumstances. I've been in roles in my professional career, my very, very adult career, where I've been told to, you know, dilute your voice. I've been told to dilute. I've been told to mute yourself. I've been told to be humble, be more humble, and don't refer to yourself as Dr. Steed. Don't refer to yourself, even though you earned it with distinction, don't refer to yourself as that, because you're going to threaten other people by the fact that you earned a doctorate degree.
Having a childhood where you mentioned that you were in a bubble and then hitting college and getting hit with this reality must have been a...
Yeah, it was a shock. It was a shock. But I can tell you that the test of a human being, a test of a person, is not so much the shock in and of itself and the fact that it can shock you, is your reaction to it and how you rebound after the reality of being in it. And for me, it wasn't that first shock that just knocked me off. It wasn't the second, it wasn't the third, it wasn't the fourth, it wasn't the fifth, it wasn't the sixth. It was just the culmination of all of those things and just the reality shock that this is your reality. Wake up in it. Wake up in it. So either you're going to allow this to not keep knock you down and keep you down, or you're going to fight for your survival and fight for your rightful place.
So in the spring, you gave this really powerful remarks at the American Jewish Committee's Passover mm-hmm, Seder, mm-hmm, leadership mm-hmm. Passover Seder. You said, I have your quote here, "Like many minority leaders, I don't think I've truly been in a position where I've ever felt fully free. I've always felt as though my wings were clipped. I've always felt invisible. I've always felt muted, like I had no voice. I've always felt passed over, looked over, stomped over, until now. I think I finally found my freedom. I finally found my voice when I attained this role of CEO as MetroHealth." It's really, really powerful. So I think what you're talking about is these clipped wings. And mm-hmm. it's not, obviously, it's not just you.
Yeah.
It's a whole big chunk of our community mm-hmm. that have to endure this every day. How do we change things?
Oh, my gosh. Where do I even begin?
Maybe we start here at MetroHealth.
Yeah. So I'm extremely proud. I'm extremely humbled. I'm extremely overjoyed at just the opportunity of being in a role where I get to be the first female. So I get to be a voice for females, where I'm the first person of color. So I get to be that voice, channeling all of my own experiences and being able to advocate for people of color, and my goodness, people of color has been disenfranchised, not only as patients and as residents of communities and but of employees. My gosh, I have lived experience that have shaped me, so I can channel that in a different way. And being at the helm, I can make a lot of powerful decisions. So I'm extremely grateful on being the first nurse to sit in this role. And all of the positive messages that sends, that after 200 years in existence, I'm the first in a lot of different ways, but I'm also shouldering a very critical responsibility, a heavy responsibility to ensure that while, yes, I am the first, I want to position this organization to ensure that I'm not the last and that we don't wait another 200 years before we widen the front door for others to step into similar positions of influence. But it's also my personal responsibility. And as I reflect back on my own career and my own navigation, is my personal responsibility to ensure that I'm leaning down and I'm making it easier for others to climb up and rise and stand on my shoulders. It didn't take me long to start to navigate myself around this organization and see people differently, see people through the lens of all of the adversity that I've lived through. But it takes more than me. So I certainly want to motivate others to do the same. And I'm motivating others and I'm holding people accountable as well in how they treat people. But all of those things combined, I think is a way in which we can do something about all of these various norms that I've experienced as a professional, I've experienced as a human being, and that I have experienced and my family has experienced as patients that didn't show up in a positive way. But again, going back to your initial question on just how do we set the tone on this? I think that the first things first is we have to create a sense of urgency. We have to create an overarching awareness that the timing is now. The timing is now to make the change that we want to see. And more specifically, we have to be the change that we want to see. I've had the doors closed on me. I've been overlooked for opportunities that I was more than qualified for. But it's just a reflection of our society. The fact that, you know, I didn't get the earned jobs that I wholeheartedly deserved, not because of anything else other than the fact that that I happen to be a person of color. I happen to be a female. And that doesn't fit necessarily well into what we, you know, how we want to shape our society. But as a person who's lived through this, I'm certainly making sure that door is absolutely wide, and that road and that pathway is not windy and no one is going to step on a crack and that rocks are not thrown against it. But most certainly it's my personal responsibility to ensure that the floor is not sticky, so you're not stuck in lower roles. And certainly I want to shatter that ceiling for you. And then underneath it, when you reach that concrete, which you will, that we blast through that concrete so you can rise even higher.
So to me sitting here, it sounds like you, as you've gone through life, you've encountered a ton of adversity, school opportunities, business, professionally, mm-hmm. With your family, with health inequities, mm-hmm. both grandmothers dying, mm-hmm. sister and mom, mm-hmm. and you've reached this point and you're like, I want to change all
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was a turning point for me. I was not intended or intentionally going down the path that I chose for my career. I was not intending to be a leader of any sort. For me, I was going to be happy being a practitioner, being on the front line. I had no problems doing that. But life hit me in so many different places. It's really how I've mourned the death of my mother that kind of springboarded me into leadership. That's when I recognized, my goodness, I'm going to have to change this if in order for things to be different. I need to get on the other side of the table. I'm on the wrong side is what I recognized on very, very early on. I really had that light bulb that went off and that springboarded me, that fast tracked me really on a path to leadership.
How long was your mom sick before she passed?
It was very short. It was a short window, but the earlier stages of it, and mind you, the ignorance of going through a scenario like this. My mother was very young. I was young. She was sick before she was sick, obviously. In the early process, she was misdiagnosed several times. It was always minor things that you know, she was told in the early beginning, because no one knew what was wrong with her. And obviously, no one was thinking that she had cancer of all things. So my mother was misdiagnosed several times over. But the point of diagnosis to the point of death was 18 months.
Mm. When did you know it was going to be terminal? And did she call you and tell you? How did that happen?
Well, so again, I'm in this la-la land. Again, I'm in my very early 20s. So I was probably 21 when I'm learning of what is going on here. And again, I'm trained as a clinician too. So I'm at the early stages of my I'm starting my career at that point. So I'm trained as a clinician. And when you're receiving all of this news, but at the top of it, everything was okay. Everything is okay. Everything is okay type of thing. The stages of denial. So it didn't really set in for a long time that when she officially got her diagnosis of leukemia, it didn't dawn on the fact, it never dawned on any of us. It never dawned on any of us that this was going to be fatal within an 18-month period. No one was ever thinking that. We all were in it to beat it. So it was always in our mind that my mother was going to win through all of it. But again, the beginning was so clunky, was so rocky. And then the end was so rocky as well, just because, again, my mother went through a bone marrow transplant. My aunt was a perfect match for the bone marrow, which was a lifesaver in and of itself. So no one ever thought that the result was going to be what it was. And there was definitely a hazy period where, communication was not adequately shared with my family, which is the experience that I was always talking about. So communication was just poor in that 18-month haze, and how it went from 0 to 100 in a very short period of time, where I don't even know how my mother ended up getting on some type of experimental treatment. But it was never communicated. It was never like a sit-down communication with the family and really talking about risks or any of that magnitude. And as I did a post-mortem and a true post-mortem review of all of my mother's paperwork, and I read through all the paperwork that it was never given to my father, myself, any of my family members. And as I read through this experimental paperwork, that apparently, and no one even knew at the time, my mother was not in her right mind at the end. So she could not properly consent for herself. So why on earth is her name signed on this paper? It was just a crazy period. What jumped out on the page for me was death, 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 in looking at this paperwork. But my mother did not die from leukemia. My mother died from an experiment. She had multi-organ failure that resulted from this experimental treatment that the family was never engaged in.
And there's a lot of needless suffering.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just went through that and processed through that. But it has been permanently imprinted and tattooed in my memory of the most horrendous experience that I never wanted to replicate. And I vowed to myself I was never going to be that type of clinician. I was never going to be that person that caused suffering to any other family member. But is permanently tattooed in my mind.
So you're the same age now as when your mom got sick, roughly?
Yes.
You think about that at all?
I do think about it. And oftentimes, especially around my mother's birthday, my birthday, my mother's anniversary of her passing away day, certain trigger points causes me to go into a deep, dark place.
If this is too much, let me know. But what were your last conversations with her like? What did she say to you at the end?
My goodness. So back then, so number one, I made a promise to her that I was going to write her story, because the one thing that this audience probably doesn't know about me is, had I not chosen the career that I went into, I was always going to be a writer. I made my mother the promise that I was going to write her book. And she titled it for me to really capture her journey through what she was experiencing. And the title of the book was Blind, Deaf, Crippled, and Crazy. And it was really highlighting her experience through her cancer journey. So over that time period, my mother lost her sight because the experimental treatment had actually impacted her sight. Deaf, because that experimental treatment also impacted her hearing to a point where she had to wear hearing aids, because it took out all of the hair follicles in the ear, and it impacted her hearing so much. Crippled, because she was so weak to a point where she couldn't stand, and she used to lose balance all the time. And crazy, because she experienced sundowners and anxiety and all of these things. But for her, it wasn't sadness. It was reality, but it reality that would cause a smile too, because of just remembering what she used to go through and those memories of thinking. So crazy as a memory for her wasn't a bad type of memory. It's like, oh my gosh, I'm losing my mind, type of thing. But long story short, she titled her own book, and you know, she made me promise I was going to write it. And over the years, I've been, you know, very slowly, I've been culminating. So I've been keeping journals over the years. So it most certainly by the time I'm finished with the journaling, it will obviously culminate into that story.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. A couple things that, you know, she was going through that, you know, she was blind and she was deaf. It was really the caregivers who were blind and who were mm-hmm. deaf. Mm-hmm. And as they still are to so many patients. Mm-hmm. So what do you think your mom is saying to you now after, she sees you really devoting your life, not only devoting your life to fixing what happened to her, but also in a position to make some real change?
I always, it brings a smile to my face just because I can honestly tell you that my mourning period or the way I've gotten through it all, I never felt like she really left. I never felt like she really left. My mother was the most brilliant, gifted, intelligent, hardworking person. And honestly, I've always felt like I've had this guardian angel. I've always felt it. And every single opportunity, and even through the adversity that I've survived through, and actually I've thrived through, my mother's always been here. And I certainly would not have been able to rise to all of the opportunities that I've had, because I've often reflected back on it. To be the age that I am and to have gone through all of the experiences that I've had and to have earned the successes that I've had, there's no way that a human being could have experienced all of that without someone looking out for them. It's just no way. I've always felt like through the hardest of circumstances, even now as I've transitioned into this role, it's been difficult. It's been extremely challenging. But when I think about the most challenging of circumstances, I've always felt I was gliding through almost very, very seamlessly. Very, I don't know, is unhuman type of circumstances that I've been able to navigate through. And it takes me back to my comment about superpower. And it sounds strange, but I feel like I have this guardian angel that has been allowing me to glide through situations that, as I think back in retrospect, my gosh, how the heck did I do that? And the only answer that I have for that is my mother has been guiding me through.
It's really wonderful, really inspiring.
Yeah.
I love how you view adversity. You say kind of welcome it.
I do. And actually, my mother taught me a lot of lessons up until 23, until when she passed. And my gosh, I use a lot of my isms is actually not my own, it's my mother's. She used to teach me so many different things, but she's the one who told me, challenge is your best friend. Challenge is your best gift. Challenge is your superpower. She used to always tell me that. And my mother told me, in order to be a winner, you need to teach yourself how to lose. Mm. She used to tell me that all the time. All the time. In order to win, you need to get dust on your knees. So a lot of the things I even share with my kids that I motivate others to do, that I challenge people to do, is to not fear failure, not fear it, and not fear challenge, not fear being uncomfortable. And I've taught myself, I've really taught myself how to build up that muscle of being uncomfortable in the most uncomfortable positions. My mother taught me how to do that. She always taught me that I was gonna need it. I was gonna need it. And everything that I did, I was gonna need to learn how to be uncomfortable. And in order to be a leader, I need to first learn how to walk from behind.
You've been here 8 months.
Nine months. Mm-hmm. I could have had a baby.
Yeah. What are some of the real memorable things, big and small, of your first three trimesters at
Oh my gosh. Oh, number one, I'm just infatuated with the people here. I fell in love with the people here. The closeness, the tightness, the connection to the community, the connection to this mission. My gosh, I just get so inspired when I think about that. And I love the tag that was created about come for the mission, stay for the culture. I just love it.
So you're glad you came?
I'm beyond. It's not even glad. I think of this as more than just a role. This is not a role. This is not a job. So you can unstrip all of those components. I truly believe I was destined to be here. And I've never felt like that about any organization I've ever been a part of. And I've loved my prior experiences. I've loved it. But I've never felt this deeply connected to an organization.
Oh, there's no coincidences.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Steed.
Yeah, this is great.
Thank you so much for listening. Prescription for Hope is an in-house production of MetroHealth's Communications Department, led by Joe Froelich and Will Duby. Prescription for Hope is edited and hosted by me, John Campanelli. More episodes are on the way, and you won't miss any of them if you subscribe to Prescription for Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much.